today, an irrational potpourri of control and contentment, or their lack.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
It really is a potpourri today. I am throwing together a bag of different topics that all happen to touch on a similar element of, I don't know if it's universal human nature or just the nature of every single human being I've met so far. I don't know which way that goes, but these are the experiences I've had throughout my life, and I do think they say something about us that we probably ought to be aware of and ought to address. And it is our need or desire to control. And in the process of doing that, to get into a position where we're fighting over things in order to bring about the result that we want. And I mean, there are examples that I intend to give today, innocuous examples, fairly ubiquitous examples, to a couple of things that I think are quite specific about what's going on in lives and in, for instance, the Southern Baptist denomination right now. And that's only one example. You don't have to be Southern Baptist to be interested in this, or at least to be affected by it. I'll say that. I shouldn't presume interest after all. But, you know, the thing that gives me the easiest sample of behaviors along these lines is just being in traffic. I always love to use traffic as an illustration anyway about things, but this one is not just an illustration. I mean, there, you know, there's road rage is a thing now. People shooting each other on the road because someone gets cut off in traffic. What on earth is going on with that? And it happens constantly. The little provocations that bring it about, and then the response to the provocation that matures it and brings it to a state of eruption, like we see in road rage. So, you know, why is it? Why is it that we're so willing? So let's take it when you're alone and driving, on the assumption that this happens. Everybody makes jokes about it. I've tried to become better at it, and I think I am much better than I used to be because I have a different sense of what I'm doing when I'm driving than I used to. But sometimes I can fall back into it too. Why on earth are people inclined, and you see this happening even in other cars on a regular basis, to raise their voice or their fist or a tiny portion of their fist, if you know what I mean, at bad drivers? Why do people feel a need to do that? We know there are bad drivers. We know they're everywhere. There are millions of people who drive in the city of Dallas. It doesn't seem likely that all of them are good drivers. So we should know that we're going to be encountering bad drivers and bad driving while we're out. And yet we respond as if we've been personally assaulted or insulted and need to do something about it. And though, you know, people who cut us off or are driving without much of a purpose, you know, it's like, put your foot on the gas and get out of the way. Or they're tailgating, or they're weaving in and out of traffic, or in a parking lot. Not that this is a personal pet peeve. They're waiting interminably for a parking space to open up. You know, oh, well, you know, that person's getting in their car. I'm just going to sit here and block the entire line of traffic behind me while I wait 30 minutes for them to get. No, it's not a personal example. I'm just making one up. Not thinking of one. At least not anymore. Anyway, the point is, why on earth do we respond with such hostility to that? Get out of the way, you know, that kind of stuff that you hear people do. And I think, you know, one of the reasons we do it, and I'll come back to both of these later in a more serious example, but I think one of the reasons we do it is a legitimate sense. It's not legitimate in the way we're expressing it, but it's a sense of righteous indignation. There is a wrong being done. You shouldn't drive that way. You shouldn't be rude to people. You shouldn't take other people's spaces and so on. So you're righting a wrong that was perpetrated against you, or even more importantly, against society as a whole. No one should be allowed to drive who behaves that way. So there's a sense of righteous indignation that goes with it. And then, and this is the part that, I mean, both of these are not justification for being so juvenile in our behavior towards each other in traffic or anywhere else. But the other one is particularly problematic, and that's trying to control other people. And more particularly, in this case, trying to control how others interact with you. And it's really, this is completely different. This is the opposite of trying to control how you interact with others. And when I say it's completely different, I mean completely. If you need to control how someone else drives to control how you drive, then you're not a good driver. I mean, the whole point in the driving lessons I had was, you know, be, in fact, back then we called it defensive driving, but I don't think that's a good term for it anymore, because most people who are defensive end up pulling a gun now. But what we meant by it was, you're prepared to drive so well that when someone else cuts you off, when someone else swerves into your lane, when another person does what will inevitably happen, not only because bad drivers are bad drivers, but because good drivers make mistakes too, that you would be prepared for it. Oh, I've got an extra lane to pull into. It's okay. You just sidled over into my lane without looking. I get it. I was prepared. It's okay. I'm all right. You've got control over yourself and how you interact with others that doesn't require you to control them. It's weird that we are so likely to want to control how the other person is responding to me, how they see my presence. Give me room to come in here, after all. Why wouldn't you? And so on. That hostility, that practically, and it turns into this sometimes with road rage, fighting about things like this is just so out of character with most of the people who are doing it. I mean, we're talking grandmother who's, you know, loving her grandkids and going to church and lifting up that tiny portion of her fist to her neighbor who cut her off in traffic. What? What happened that we were so angry that we were willing to do that? A different expression of it. Let me give you a different expression. I had four kids. They grew up and became adults, mostly. That's a joke. They are all adults. I mean, I think my youngest is now 33 years old. I think that's right. That's really close to correct. They're 32 right now. They're 33 right now. Yes, thank you. Just had a birthday, as it turns out. Okay, anyway, back to the point. So I grew up having four children at a time, sometimes all together, all four, in the car at the same time. So I learned to ignore things and just act as if things weren't happening. But it was always back there. You know, you could hear what was going on. And one of the weirdest things was learning, and I realized that I had done the same thing when I was growing up, but you would have the kids arguing about something that was clearly, factually, evidentially going to be revealed in a minute or 2 minutes or 5 minutes. No, it's not. It's green. No, it's black, you know, or no, it's number 32. No, it's number 31. Whatever it was, it's 4 miles. No, it's two. No, it's three. No, it's going to take 10 minutes. Big arguments between the kids. And again, I'm like living in oblivion in the front seat, acting as if they're not saying anything because I was a great dad or a terrible dad. I'm not sure which. But the point is, I didn't care. But as I was listening to it, I started realizing how absurd it was to take a dogged position on something argumentatively when you were going to everyone was going to know the outcome in about 2 minutes. Why argue about it? Why not just say, I think it's two. No, I think it's four. Well, let's wait and see. Why wouldn't you just do that instead of having this rabid argument about it, a fight about it? And I think it's for the same reason. It has something to do with trying to control how other people are thinking and what the results of their behaviors are going to be and so on. And so there are some particular illustrations of this. I think in the way adults, I can put that in air quotes, they are adults biologically, but I mean a lot of us are adults biologically and we waver, mentally, emotionally, and relationally. We're back and forth on whether we're adults or not. But there are lots of examples of this. And one of the examples, just has to do with, I was reading Thomas Hobbes recently. I'm teaching a class on political theory right now, and I've taught it a couple of times. And one of the things that we read is a little section from Thomas Hobbes's Leviathan. The book Leviathan is it's an accounting of political theory that in which the Leviathan is an expression of political authority. It's a sovereign within a state. And the sovereign may be expressed in an individual or a body, but it's a sovereign expression within the state. You don't care. But the title of the book is Leviathan. So in Leviathan, chapter 18, in the third section or so of that, he says this: no man can without injustice protest against the institution of the sovereign declared by the major part. What that means is, once an election is done, you can't protest the election. Who won, and you have to be okay with that, and then you have to move on forward. And his reasoning for that is what I want to read you. I'm going to read you this paragraph, and it's from Thomas Hobbes, so we're talking 17th century, and it's a little cumbersome language, but I think you'll get it as we're reading through it. And what he's saying is, and what he has established is, that the natural state of man, and this is, again, Thomas Hobbes, so it's hundreds of years ago, and we're just trying to figure out how we're supposed to be in a political society with each other when we're not all recognizing the inherent authority of the monarch, and the Reformation's already happened, and we're overthrowing all kinds of authority. So, what are we supposed to do to find our unification, and so on? In all of that, what he describes is this, and this is after the chapter where he has said, basically, the natural state of man is in warfare. We are competing with each other. I mean, it's only natural. You want stuff. Everybody else wants the same stuff, so everybody fights for the stuff. You fight individually, you fight in groups, but even when you're in groups as individuals, you end up fighting afterwards and so on. That's the natural state of man, but what we need is a stable social state of man that goes beyond that. That would be the political state. And so in establishing the political state, he talks about having a sovereign, having some authority in the political sphere that is established, that's peaceful, and that's maintainable, and so static in some way, stable. And so this is part of that description. So if you have an institutional form of political stability, then that's going to include, if you're in a democratic society of any kind at all, or a society where the rule is established by consent. It doesn't matter whether it's elections or something else, but in this case, I'm using elections as the illustration. If the rule is by consent, well, then of course it's not every individual's consent. That would be as absurd as going back to a state of warfare. Instead, it has to be the majority whose consent is being recognized, and that majority has to be recognized also by the minority. Otherwise, you would just be in a constant state of warfare again, where every individual is fighting constantly about things. And so he says it this way: no man can without injustice protest, this is quoting Hobbes, against the institution of the sovereign declared by the major part. Thirdly, and this is how he says it, so now is the paragraph of explanation: because the major part hath by consenting voices declared a sovereign. So they've voted, they've elected, they've met, they've somehow come to an agreement. And the majority have declared who the sovereign should be. He that dissented from that vote, obviously, must now consent with the rest. That is, be contented to avow all the actions he shall do, or else justly be destroyed by the rest. For if he voluntarily entered into the congregation of them that were assembled, he sufficiently declared thereby his will, and therefore tacitly covenanted to stand to what the major part should ordain. And therefore, if he refused to stand thereto, or make protestation against any of their decrees, he does contrary to his covenant, and therefore unjustly. And whether he be of the congregation or not, and whether his consent be asked or not, he must either submit to their decrees or be left in the condition of war that he was in before, wherein he might without injustice be destroyed by any man whatsoever. Now, the point of Hobbes's paragraph is that we came together into a group because we needed that group. We knew we needed that group. We needed that, in a broader sense, society. We needed the organization, whatever it was. That's what we agreed to. And if every time you, as a group, take an action, you dissent and disagree to the extent that you, let's say, quit it or go somewhere else or fight against everyone that voted that way, well, then you might as well never have joined the group. The whole point of being a part of that society is that you value it so much that you know you need the movement of the whole society that you have to consent to the actions of the majority. You have to consent to cooperating within the society under the rule of the majority. Obviously, there are all kinds of caveats and protections that go with that, but the basic idea is inevitable. The political implication is obvious. Just as an example, when I served on a jury, and I think I mentioned this in one previous episode ages ago, but when I served on a jury, and I've done it several times, I've gone to serve on a jury. When I've done that, the judges give instructions, and they also give usually a little civics speech right at the beginning. And so there was one particular judge who gave a civic speech, and it was in the criminal trial that I actually did serve in all the way to the end, by the way. This is just coincidental. But in that courtroom, he said, you know, I know this is a nuisance and blah, blah, all the regular hedging you would expect someone to do. But then he said, I mean, this is the cornerstone of our democracy, your willingness to do this, because instead of settling this matter out in the streets, instead of having a mob lynch someone, instead of having lawsuits settled by people fighting it out or dueling or with violence on the streets, we've moved it into a courtroom where there is formality and procedure and decisions are made rationally, even if they're irrational decisions. It's with the tool of rationality that decisions are made in a way that's peaceable, that maintains the order of society. Now, there's some creepiness in that, okay? I'll admit. The creepiness of it is we're glad as a, and this is, I know not all of us are, I'm saying it as a society as a whole, we're perfectly glad to put some innocent people in prison as long as we can keep the order of society right. That's the reality of our society. So I know there's plenty of creepy behind this, but there's also something really valuable to understand about the nature of human society, that by being a part of it, you have to have decided that you're willing to sacrifice some of the value of individual expression that you would have had if you were all by yourself out in the desert with no one around, that you are willing to sacrifice that for the benefit that comes from being in an organized, ordered, somewhat peaceful society. And the desire for that means you have to have agreed inherently to sacrificing sometimes being the only person who's right. And instead, realizing, this is where the election went. So that's where we're going to go as a society. Elections with unfavorable outcomes, which are inherently unfavorable to the minority, elections with unfavorable outcomes are an implicit part of being a member of a society. And it's not in any way feasible or reasonable, neither. And it's certainly not moral. You can't pretend that you're acknowledging the value of the golden rule, do unto others as you have them do unto you. If what you mean is, if I win the election, it's valid. If I don't win the election, it's not valid. That's not possible. And so it creates a contradiction with the desire you have to be a part of that society and with the moral commitment that you have to be a part of that society. There's an implication for that, by the way, in church polity when you have a congregational polity, when you have a church that's organized around the congregation being able to vote about certain things. And by the way, congregations always vote. Sometimes they vote with their feet. Sometimes they vote with their pocketbooks. This is one of the things Dr. Alan Street used to say about churches when he was actively acting as a professor here at Criswell College. Fantastic author, brilliant person. But one of the things that he said that I thought was always fascinating was, it doesn't matter whether your church has a congregational polity or not. The congregation still gets to vote. They just vote with their feet or they vote with their pocketbooks instead of voting with a ballot in the congregation. But if you have a church that votes, that has congregational meetings, and the congregation expresses their will in a vote, and you have people who attend that meeting, and their intent is, if this vote goes one way, I'll stay. If the vote goes the other way, I'm leaving. Then they should go ahead and leave. And I mean it when I'm saying that. What I mean is, in reality, they should decide that's not the right attitude to have. Because to participate in a vote you are not willing to lose is not to participate honestly in that society. That doesn't mean that the moral significance of a given vote is not huge, enormous. I grant all of that. The issues that I vote about matter to me. But the commitment we make to being part of an election is that we value the outcome of the election, which can't be the case if we only value the outcome of the election if we win it. That's not valuing the outcome of the election. That's only valuing your own opinion about what ought to happen. And that's not what it means to be part of a whole society. That's just choosing schism over everything else. So there is a part of us that we have to deal with this, and I mean us as individuals, we have to deal with, which is the part of us that's yelling and screaming on the inside and raising our fist and saying, if you vote that way, you're destroying our whole society. And yet you value that society enough to participate in the vote. And instead of having to control things with threats of violence or evacuation, we recognized that we don't control the outcomes of elections. We don't control the direction of society. We can influence it. We'll come back and talk about that more later. And hopefully we have all of the great influence that we ought to have. But you know, Paul's statements, just to give a Christian slant to this for a moment, Paul's statements in Scripture about the authorities, Jesus' statements about Caesar, all of the teachings in Scripture about the authorities that exist, they're premised on the idea that the authorities might be awful. And yet, we, to be a part of that society, still have to respect that authority. And this is not an ancillary truth of Christianity. This is a core truth in Christianity. To live solely for your flesh or to live solely in rebellion against authority is to live as a non-Christian. Read it anywhere in the New Testament. It's a clear contradiction with the basic values of Christianity. Why would that be? Because, you know, in Christianity we have faith, and the nature of faith is that we believe God, the ultimate sovereign, the one who isn't voted for or against. He just is. He is already in charge. And if we believe that, then we're able to justify having hope and faith, even when everything has gone wrong, which a lot of people think is the case right now or was the case 4 years ago, by the way. So when it comes to elections, it's weird that people who express faith in a sovereign God can't express that faith by refraining from fighting and controlling the outcome of things in this world. It's really weird that we're that way. We're like little children arguing in the back seat. We just go back to the behaviors we had when we were younger. I'll talk more about that later too. You know, as an example of where, you know, I think some of my understanding of how these things are came about, there is, you know, I was a debater in high school. I've mentioned this many times. It may be obvious, may not be obvious, whatever. But I was a debater, and it was a big thing for me. I mean, it helped. You know, some people would say it shaped the way you speak or think. I think in reality, I was attracted to it because of the way I speak and think. I mean, it was just something naturally interesting to me to be in debate. And I met a gentleman. He ran some nursing homes when I was a teenager and I was a debater. And he was he was a businessman and he made a lot of money, and I'm not sure all of it was earned legitimately. So I'll say it about that way. I'm not sure. I'll just leave it there. But he definitely had a tainted reputation among people who were in that industry. I can say that. So regardless, I mean, he was a pretty rough character, but a lot of money and a big Texas kind of personality, you know, so opinions about everything. And I know the answer to everything kind of opinion. Now, again, I actually enjoyed being around him and didn't mind conversations with him. Not only didn't just not mind them. I enjoyed them. But it was fun talking with this guy. And one of the things we talked about one time, he said, I don't know if he was just insulting me on purpose or if it just came out of him naturally, you know? But he said, you know what I don't like about debaters is that, of course, that was my whole thing. I was a debater. And he knew it, of course. And he said, you know, there's a real weakness among debaters. It's the thing I hate about debaters. And that is they can see both sides of everything. They hear something and they can make either side sound right, and they can think on both sides, and you end up with people who don't have convictions about anything. This from a man who may have been cheating old people out of their retirements in nursing homes, but whatever. That's a different story. And again, I don't have proof of anything. I just know the reputation that he had. Regardless, I just thought, he thinks that's a negative. I've spent, you know, years learning how to see past the end of my own nose and how to see the weaknesses in my own arguments, and therefore see the weaknesses in everyone's arguments. And they are abundant, by the way. But after I see all of those things, I feel like, hey, I'm in a better place. I think I can grasp things better because he's right. I was a lot less absolute in my understanding of reality. I was no less absolute in my rhetoric, man, because once I picked a side, it was like, I was just going to prove my point no matter what, because all that mattered was winning the debate. I was the consummate sophist, if you put it in Plato's terms or in classical Greek terms. The point is, I did learn in that context to think about things more roundly and I think more soundly. And he viewed that as a weakness, that a person could see both sides of the same argument. I saw that, and I now that I'm much older, I mean, that's the whole strength of what I got from that season of my life, was learning that I could be quicker than everyone else at the time. I'm 61. I've slowed down a bit, I admit it, even rhetorically. But at that time, I could run circles with the best of them around all the rhetoric that everyone else was putting out. We could keep up and with everybody and take them down, you know, if we needed to, my debate partner and I. And I loved doing that. And I know, I hear it all the time. I see the 18 and 22 and 28 and 34-year-olds who are, the light shining in darkness with the truth of conservatism on one side, liberalism on the other side, and they know all things, and they can put it out there so fast and so sharp and with such razor pointedness that everybody just loses the argument to them. But I see all of that and know that there's always an answer. There's always a response, and how quick you are doesn't mean you are righter than the other person. It just means you're quicker. Your repartee is a little sharper. But it also means you may not need to take the time to really examine all the arguments the way you would if you really had to follow things through to their end instead of just to the point where nobody's willing to argue with you anymore. So I win. I'm the senator. I've heard people say that about one of our senators in Texas. They talk about how rapier sharp his wit was and how he gained his position by that. And in all of that, my response was, yeah, I've been around those people, and they're not the ones who are always telling the truth or arriving at it. Not because they're lying, but because they know if I can just respond quickly enough, often enough, people give up and they realize they're not going to win the argument with me. So they just kind of back away. It's a strength to be able to recognize in that, that even when I've won an argument, I may still be wrong. Even when I've convinced the other side to agree with me, I may still be wrong. And I, you know, where I wouldn't have cared before, you know, hey, winning's the only thing that matters. More than winning matters. There is a God who knows a lot more than I do, no matter how sharp my wit is. And when I'm done arguing with him, he's still right, regardless of how I feel about the argument. And I am not going to measure up to him until I see him face to face. So I don't want a point where I'm just satisfied that my rhetoric's good enough. I always want to be hungering for more. I think that's a good strength that came out of being in that position where I could see both sides all of the time. And so we do this in so many different ways. A lot of times with rhetoric, you know, we're just trying to control people or control the circumstance, get it back in the box where we're more comfortable with it. And so somebody's attacking us, making us uncomfortable, then, you know, you look funny and your mother dresses you in army boots or something like that. It's, we're always, a tu quoque is sufficient. Oh yeah, well, what about you? Because it pushes the pressure back on that other person. So anyway, the point is, we're always trying to control people, unfortunately. I mean, this is not a healthy part of us. It's just part of us. And one of the ways that that happened for me, most prominently in all of my experience since I was a teenager, is in the areas is in the area of doctrine, where we're trying to control other people's doctrine, which is really weird. Now, I get it. So we use language theologically when we're talking about doctrinal issues, for instance, where we prioritize them. So, for instance, we'll talk about an issue of primary importance. This is a primary doctrine, and then secondary, and then tertiary doctrines. And I, you know, if I'm thinking of a primary doctrine, you know, it's Jesus is Lord, the resurrection, you know, something fundamental to what it means simply to define what it is to be Christian, for instance. And then you have secondary issues. And I would have put in the category of secondary when I was younger, especially. I mean, I know people who would put in the category of primary things that are just clearly and obviously not primary theological issues. For instance, I believe in immersing people when you baptize them. So let's put them all the way under the water, you know, and I've told the story before of how the first time I baptized somebody, they didn't quite go all the way under. And so I had to do it again because somebody in the crowd noticed, you know, that kind of stuff when I was a kid, young, I was a teenager. Anyway, the point is, if I disagree with somebody and they believe it's okay, we'll sprinkle people instead of immersing them, then yeah, I disagree and I'll do it my way and you do it your way. But is that a primary theological issue? Obviously not. So those kinds of things fall into either the secondary or tertiary category. And, which ones fall in which category isn't even important for this part of the conversation, except to say that normally when we're doing that, when we're creating primary theological categories and then secondary and tertiary, we're doing it in order to decide whether we co-labor with someone. And that's pretty much it. You know, so are we in the same denomination or not? Well, do we believe in this liturgical style or not? Do we believe in this particular approach to church polity or not? And more than anything else, it just has to do with the fact that we are comfortable doing things in one direction, or we think Scripture inclines, if not necessarily demands, in that direction. And so, I mean, we're going to do it this way anyway, so why not just be around people who are going to do it that way, right? So we're just, you know, who do I co-labor with? And it changes depending on what we're co-laboring about, so that's fine. But in this case, that's not what I mean, because what we end up doing is putting these theological distinctions into a category where we say, not only am I not comfortable with you doing it, but I can't allow you to do that and even be in the same category as I'm in. So for instance, if I'm Baptist, you can't be Baptist if you do that. If I'm Southern Baptist, you can't be Southern Baptist if you do that. I need to either stop you from doing it, control you in that way, or stop you from claiming any association with me so that no one could possibly think that we're connected in any way. And if you want an example of where we're exercising control doctrinally this way, there is really low-hanging fruit in the Southern Baptist Convention right now for that point. I mean, so low-hanging, every time I walk under the tree, it's just slapping me in the face. And it ought to make us a little uncomfortable that it's that high a priority. And I'll say it this way. There's this thing being proposed in the Southern Baptist Convention right now about amending our Constitution so that it has a restriction so that we would understand what it means to be in friendly cooperation. And that's how Baptists understand their relationship with each other. We just cooperate with each other. Everybody's autonomous, but we cooperate with each other. And so in the Constitution, Article 3 of the Constitution, and the Baptist Press says it this way, lists 5 points that place churches within the definition of cooperation with the SBC. The amended motion that, now this is the law amendment, it's what it's called. It's just named after a person named Law who proposed the amendment. The law amendment motion calls for a 6th restriction or requirement for a church to be seen as being in cooperation with the SBC. And what it adds is this, adding churches that affirm, appoint, or employ only men as any kind of pastor or elder as qualified by Scripture. Now, that statement in itself is not shocking to most Southern Baptists because it's in the Baptist faith and message, which is just a doctrinal statement that we share as Southern Baptists that allows us to say, hey, this is what it means if you want to send us money and join in the mission efforts and all that kind of stuff we do. This is the kind of stuff we stand for. If you are in agreement with it, come on in. If you're not, you probably wouldn't want to be a part. That's kind of how we used it. But now it's being turned in a slightly different direction. And it's, you know, it's not like we haven't been doing this for a long time, turning in this direction, where we can use the doctrinal statement to exclude people, not to clarify who we are, but just to exclude people. You're not welcome if you don't agree with this particular part of the Baptist faith and message. And it is about particular parts because there are a bajillion things in the Baptist faith and message issue, like, for instance, having to deal with racism, saying that we want to deal with the issue of racism, acknowledging that all the races are people of equal dignity and so on. And there are plenty of churches that don't cooperate with that, and we don't pick them out. But there are other ones also where we just don't all have to agree on everything, but we have a sense of who we are on the basis of the Baptist faith and message. But we pick out one or two, and we say, you know, if you don't agree with this one, we're not even going to let you give us money if you want to. And that's what we're doing right now with the law amendment about having any women in a position that can be referred to as pastor. So it doesn't matter whether it's pastor of care to senior adults or pastor of children's ministry or whatever. If that title is used, then the church is not being seen as being in a healthy form of cooperation with the convention. Now, what I find just odd here, it seems particularly curious, off-putting to me, at least ironic, that that right at the moment, and I mean the same year that the sex abuse crisis comes to a head, when we have a real opportunity to do something about this long history of covering up abuses and allowing pastors to move from one setting to the next in order to practice their predation. It's just weird that the same year that we have an opportunity to do something about sex abuse in Southern Baptist churches, we instead turn our attention to preventing other churches, to preventing any congregation out there from having women serve as their pastors, which for the entire history of the Southern Baptist Convention, we've had some. Not many, because you know, it's not a friendly place to have that type of setup in your church. But we've always had some who said, hey, I want to support your missionaries anyway. I know you don't like me being their pastor, but here's the money. So let us support your missionaries. We've always had that. We choose the same year that the sex abuse crisis comes to a head to figure out a way to eliminate from our group, our people, anyone who would allow a woman to have a title of being the pastor in the church. And why? So why is this so ironic, or why is it so weird that it would happen at the same time? And just think about it with me. So we have a crisis. The Sex Abuse Task Force identifies it, studies it for a long time, and then finally comes up with this report that says, you guys need to do something about this, right? So we have this crisis, which is at least partially shaped. Now, I don't know how much, but it's at least partially shaped by the dearth of avenues for girls and women who've been violated in some way to be able to express their concerns or their experience, their own experience, with someone who would automatically have a couple of things. One, a sympathetic ear. Automatically, sort of inherently, have the ability to hear what's being described, and then also have the real authority to act. And you say, well, anybody can have a sympathetic ear. Yeah, saying to a woman who's been abused by a male authority figure, go speak to a male authority figure and tell them what happened to you. That's not the best setting, right? I mean, everybody kind of knows that. It's not difficult to be aware of that. So when I say an inherently sympathetic ear, I mean being able to say, hey, we have a woman who would like to hear what you have to say. But not just any woman. Here's a woman who can do something about it. She'll take up your cause. She'll be your advocate. So has real authority to act. We don't have that in Southern Baptist churches because of our doctrine, because of what we believe about women being pastors in the church. And at some point, I think, by the way, this is a side note, at some point, I think we have to divide that out and say, well, fine, we don't want women to be the pastors in our churches. But that doesn't mean a woman couldn't have any spiritual authority or couldn't have some way to have an independent sort of input or authority into the congregation that would give this outlet for the expression of abuses that needs to be had in many contexts. So that as a side note. So why do I think this is so ironic? Think about it. In the moment when our convention is confronted, and I say our because I'm Southern Baptist, not because everybody listening is, in the moment when my convention is confronted with that whole milieu, with that crisis, the response is not simply to reaffirm the doctrinal statement we've held for 25 years. That would be one thing. Hey, we want to reaffirm that this is what we believe as a group of churches. Not that. It's more. It's to enforce the one part of it that can keep a woman from having real authority in the church. And we keep it so strictly, we enforce that one part now, we want to so strictly that we start kicking those churches out. Not the ones with abuse, but the ones where there might be a built-in avenue for dealing with that abuse. That's a little weird that would happen right now. And how does that pertain to what I've been talking about through this whole episode? Because it just comes down to control. Well, we're going to lose control. We're going to lose control of what we have right now. And we need to maintain that control. So we need to assert it with more authority, and we need to enforce it against those people who disagree with us. And obviously, I think that's problematic. And I don't think it's rooted in our spirituality or the depth of our commitment to Scripture. I think it's rooted in our humanity, just who we are as people. We want to control things. When they seem to be getting out of hand, exert more control, speak more loudly, be more, you know, invigorated in the fight. I'll give you a completely different example, a completely different direction, the example of immigration. And there are people, so just to be clear, on the issue of immigration itself, on the conservative side and on the liberal side, people just use it as a football. They just use it as a way to get political support. I know that. You know that. We've all encountered it. It's frustrating because nobody wants progress on it because it makes such good rhetoric for political ads on both sides. Very sadly, that's the case. But I do find it challenging to understand why we become, and you know, this is about when we become so belligerent, when our rhetoric becomes so bombastic, you know, so deep-seated and filled with hate and things like that. Why do we do that? Why do we respond with words like invasion, you know, and the idea that even if you listen to political ads in the season we're in right now, I'm recording this toward the end of February when there's just been a bajillion, I've said bajillion too many times in this episode, so I'll move on from it now, ads, political ads right now, who use the word illegal alien. They don't even say alien anymore. It's just illegals, those illegals. And we're ramping up the rhetoric so that we can make all these claims. He's going to stop the invasion, things like that. Why is it that we're so dead set on ramping up the rhetoric like that? And why is that built into our sense of needing to make it as hard as possible for migrants to try to make their way here? Now, I know the answer is right now because we've already built up all the rhetoric, but I mean, we are a nation of immigrants. Everybody knows that. People on both sides of the issue know that. We are immigrants, and we know that we're built on immigration, and we know that there's room for immigrants, people to come in, get a job, earn their living, and so on. We make room for that every year, all the time. Yeah, but these numbers are so great. Yeah, I mean, yeah, and no, there's room. If there's not, then the economy will slow them down and they'll stop coming in. But right now there's room and people make for economic success. So why do we make it so hard for some migrants to try to make their way here? And I think there are two things in our nature that would precipitate us doing that. Again, it's not to say there aren't any bad things going on that ought to be fixed. There are. I acknowledge all of that. I'm just talking about the attitude side of it. And I think what's coming out in our attitude is a couple of different things. Number one, sometimes we do revert to our sort of juvenile state of territorial protection. When we're younger, we're that way. As we get older, we learn, for instance, that economies can grow and it's not a zero-sum game. And because the guy down the street has a successful store, it doesn't mean mine will be unsuccessful. In fact, everybody's looking to have a successful anchor store in their strip, right? Everybody wants that because it makes everybody more prosperous. So you start to learn those things as you get older. But when you're younger, you think everything is a zero-sum game. Oh, if people like him, they must not like me. So I'm feeling unliked, so I'm going to attack him. I'm going to find a way to belittle him. Lowering someone else was the only way to lift ourselves up. That's when we were young, you know, when we were kids. But our general tendency is to revert to the emotional comforts we found in youth. I mean, just think of, you know, your favorite music. It's the music you gained when you were young, that you learned when you were young, that you were attracted to when you were young. Those are comfortable things. Comfort foods are things that remind you of when you were young. Those, and it's the same thing with these emotions. I think territoriality and shade toward the outsiders, you know, is a part of that in us. And so there's a little of that. But then the second thing I think is that there is a sort of pay it forward vindictiveness that shows itself whenever we have struggled for something. And I'd love to talk about our corporate understanding of ourselves and our communal nature and all that kind of stuff at this point, but you'll have to go back and listen to another episode to get all of that. It would make it too much for today. But I do want you to hear this. I think we think of ourselves as having struggled for it, earned it. I've got something here, and it's taken my whole life to get it. And then if we see someone else get it more easily, well, they just show up and they're taking advantage of our jobs. They're taking our stuff. Then it, you know, we don't want that. We don't want them to get it more easily. I experienced this in my doctoral program. That you know, it was hard. I did it at UTA, and it was a hard program. It's a lot of classes. It's a lot of writing. It's a lot of humility. humiliation, I guess, is the term you put on it, you know, and the way people treat you. And sometimes it was sometimes it was direct as a professor saying, well, I'll tell you what, when I had to write my papers, and they'd talk about the grueling experience they went through, and then they'd put you through the same grueling experience. It's like, was it helpful to you or just grueling? It didn't really matter. They just wanted to convey the psychological experience of it. And it's sort of that way now that I'm in higher education. I know, looking down the pipeline at the students coming through now, a lot of professors are sort of like, well, it wasn't that easy when I went through, so I'm going to make these students suffer too. As if that's part of what's necessary for us to achieve the character we should have. And there was a lot of that kind of vindictiveness, even from the immigrant community itself, in expressions made after the Reagan amnesty in 86. I remember this from the students, students and younger people that I was around especially. And people would wonder, you know, why on earth is, for instance, in the Hispanic community back then, again, this is 40 years ago that this was happening, but I would hear my Hispanic friends saying, they didn't favor Reagan's amnesty, they didn't like it at all. And when I would inquire about why, you know, they would describe not something going on in that amnesty, but what they went through. Well, you know what I went through? I was in the process for years. I had to pay this many dollars. I had to get this many lawyers. And now these people are just coming in and getting it for free. That's what I mean by the pay it forward vindictiveness, you know, that we can have. It just feels wrong. It's a righteous indignation. Why are they getting what cost us so much? And that, I don't think, is where we want to live, you know, where we want everyone else to have to suffer the way we did. I don't think that's what we're really called to be like. And I know that's not the only reason people care about that issue. But to the extent that it is that, and it is that sometimes, I think we could do better. So, you know, so here's the thing I've been talking about all day. But let me conclude this discussion about how controlling we try to be and why we get into fights like this and why our behavior turns in this direction so often, why it becomes so absolute and so on, with just a couple of observations. And these are general problems that arise when we're trying to control things that are actually outside of our purview. So when you do that, when we do that, and we all do it at times, number one, when we're trying to control things that are outside our purview, we are destroying any potential we have for contentment. Two groups knew this. I could spend a long time on this, and I'm not going to, but the Stoics and the Epicureans, historically, the two dominant philosophical perspectives that Paul addresses on Mars Hill, you know, both of those groups recognized this particular thing. The Stoics knew we had to find the difference between the things that were and weren't controlled by us, the things that are in us and the things that are outside of us. It becomes what Reinhold Niebuhr puts down in the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. It's a particularly good wording of a prayer that's been around for ages. And it is an expression of this. The Epicureans and the Stoics both knew. And the Epicureans put it in the form of saying you need to recognize you don't have control over anything. Not only that, you don't need control over anything to find contentment. So our contentment, you know, like Paul describes in Philippians 4, is a critical part of Christianity. It's who we are as believers because we know that when we have Christ, we can be content with him. And when we're not acting that way, we're being against the very thing that we say we believe. By the way, even acknowledging all of that about contentment, there is a risk that goes with this, because on the inverse side of that problem, the awareness that I can be content with things as they are can lead to this opiate effect, the way Marx describes religion as the opiate of the masses. I know that's translated in different ways, but that's one of the ways of saying it. And that's addressing the reality that we can choose to be complacent rather than simply content, a discussion for another day as well. I'm not encouraging that. I'm not saying you look at the world and just say, oh, well, que sera, sera. You know, people just gonna do what people gonna do. I'm not saying that at all. But influence, the need that we have to make a difference, we are called to be salt and light in the world, to use the overused trope. Influence is not the same thing as control. Exerting influence doesn't generate the same fear and anger that the attempt to exert control generates. And so, I'd put it this way. If we're going to see ourselves as rulers, like I'm going to control everything, we can use the word ruler. And the ruler has this built-in ambiguity to it. If we're going to see ourselves as rulers, let's be the kind who set the measured, 12-inch standard, not the ones who whack students on the back of their hands. Let's say you're hearing all of this and you disagree. By the nature of the discussion, I'm okay with that. I don't need to control you. I tried, but it didn't work out. I just hope to give you space to let go of the things you can't change, so you and I can put a little more focus on changing the things we can.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.